We're back on Ring of Fire on Air America Radio. I'm Mike Papantonio in Pensacola, Florida, with Bobby Kennedy at the Pace Law School in White Plains, New York. We have two words for Republican buddies of Jack Abramoff, Ralph Reed. Ahead, we'll talk with Georgia Democrat insider Andy Childers about the Abramoff rub-off factor and what it could mean in November. We'll also be taking your calls at 866-389-FIRE. That's 866-389-3473. Or email us, info@ringoffireradio.com.
Joining us now is Greg Pallast, who's back with us for the second time to talk about his New York Times bestseller, Armed Madhouse. You made it onto the bestseller list already.
Oh, yeah.
That's great.
Despite not having any Coulter vision.
I know, that's amazing. Greg is an investigative journalist. Are you the last one left?
Well, as you know, it's investigative reporting, Bobby, is illegal under Patriot Act 3, so I have to do it from England for BBC television. It's old-fashioned investigative reporting. I mean, to get my story, for example, on oil in Iraq, you know, I had to wear a wire, I had to do secret tape recording, false fronts, the whole thing.
Well, the product is well worth it. This is an exciting story. It's like a spy thriller, and you've got two really great chapters on the election and how the 2004 election was stolen. Basically doing what I did in my Rolling Stone piece in Ohio, doing that for the whole country.
Exactly.
Doing a lot of original reporting, which is fantastic. But I want to talk to you about something else today, which is your description, which is one of the best descriptions that I've read, about what we're doing in Iraq and how this was driven by the oil industry on the one hand and by these kind of theocratic neocons.
Fundamentalists
from their lofty think tanks in Washington, who essentially used us all as guinea pigs in their corporate cronyism experiment. Let me read this. On March 27th, 2003, Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul Wolfowitz testified before Congress, quote, "There's a lot of money to pay for this that doesn't have to be from the U.S. taxpayer." He's talking about the war in Iraq, that he's testifying that it's not going to cost us a dime. And where would these billions and billions come from? Well, it starts with the assets of the Iraqi people. We're dealing with a country that can really finance its own reconstruction and relatively soon. When he said that, he knew it was a lie.
Yes. I spent about a year trying to figure out where Wolfowitz got this idea that oil could gush forth from the desert like manna, like some type of biblical miracle. And sure enough, I got to the guys in charge of coming up with the number at the Energy Information Administration, and they basically said, we don't know where Wolfowitz got it. We gave the Defense Department completely different numbers. And we said, you know, the oil infrastructure of Iraq's going to be on fire, so you ain't going to get a lot of they're not going to be able to pay for their own bombing, guys.
But even before the bombing occurred,
yes.
There wasn't enough oil being pumped because there'd been no investment in the infrastructure, and the biggest oil fields had already been bombed in the previous
conflict. Yeah, so one of the problems was Wolfowitz faking it or lying to us. The answer is, yes, he was given different information than what he testified to. So in other words, he wasn't telling the truth. Did he perjure himself? No. Under the law, you have to raise your hand and swear an oath to tell the truth, so help me God. And interestingly, the Bush boys do not testify under oath. Ever since Elliot Abrams got convicted of perjury in the Iran-Contra scandal, these guys avoid raising their hand and saying, I'm telling you the truth. They didn't learn to tell the truth. They learned to stop swearing to tell the truth. It was amazing.
And they've somehow got this very compliant, lie-on-your-back doormat Congress to agree with that.
But what's happening here is that, on the other hand, Wolfowitz ultimately, as you know, got fired from the Defense Department. Now, a lot of us may think becoming president of the World Bank is a nice job, but he was basically tossed out on his ear from the center of power, from the war room where you get to move the toy tanks around. And that's because he and his neocon crowd ended up in a fight with big oil, because ultimately Wolfowitz and gang wanted Iraq to expand its oil production, bring down the price of oil worldwide, and their aim was not because they wanted us to fill up our Hummers cheaply. They wanted to bring down the House of Saud. You bring down the price of oil, you bring down the House of Saud. The problem is you also bring down the House of Bush and the House of James Baker and the House of Exxon and the House of Royal Dutch Shell. So that wasn't going to happen.
Let's talk about this. I mean, what the neocons wanted was to destroy OPEC, because they have a theology that says the free market is everything. And if you have a true free market, there is a lot of oil out there.
That's right.
And if Iraq was allowed to produce and sell all the oil it has, we'd be having $20 a barrel oil.
Yes, we had that under Bill Clinton when it was cheaper than peanut butter. Now it's up above $70 a barrel, which is not a goof-up. That's mission accomplished if you read the documents that I saw. Because, I mean, where the chapter begins on oil in our madhouse is that, you know, let's face it, there's a lot of conspiracy nuts think that Bush had secret plans for the oil fields of Iraq before the tanks rolled. And it's not true, because he had two plans, and this is what we found. We spent 2 years getting this stuff. The neocon plan was in a 101-page document, which called for what they, the term they use is privatization, that is selling off all the oil fields of Iraq. And the weird thing was, is that the objection to grabbing the oil fields of Iraq with, you know, putting in the Abrams tanks and selling off their oil, I mean, it didn't matter that the Iraqis objected. What mattered was that big oil, oddly enough, objected. And that's when we got the big oil plan, a 300-page document, which, as it turned out, was written by the James Baker Institute. Now, James Baker, for those who don't know, he used to be the Secretary of State under Bush Sr. Now he's the lawyer, his firm is counsel for Exxon Petroleum and the Saudi Arabian government. And Exxon and the Saudi Arabians and big oil did not want to own the fields. That's not how the game is played. They want to control the fields. They get something called production sharing agreements. They don't like bids. They have no-bid deals. Whoever has to be greased gets greased. They get a no-bid deal. And most important, the oil, because it's still nominally owned by the government, there is a cap placed on the oil production by OPEC and effectively by Saudi Arabia. And they wanted to make sure that Iraq would never, ever bust its quota and flood the oil market.
Right. You would expect, one would expect, well, it would be great for the oil industry if you sold off and privatized all the oil in Iraq. But in fact, that's the last thing they want, because they may not end up with it. It may end up in the hands of many, many different people or entities. Right. And those people would each have an incentive to break the OPEC consortium and sell their assets as quickly as possible. That would be bad for big oil because, as you say, they have production deals with the OPEC governments where they get a percentage.
That's
so
right.
Their cut comes from the shortage. The less oil there is on the market, the more money they're going to make. Not
you
only that, but as you point out in your book, Exxon and the American oil companies all own big oil fields in the United States. And those are billions of dollars worth of oil still in them. Well, if the price of oil is at $78 a barrel, it means they have trillions of dollars of oil. So the stronger OPEC is, the richer America's oil companies get. And this war in Iraq has been the best thing in the world for them. They've made the largest profits in the history of the world. The interesting thing about your book is you show how it was all planned from the beginning.
Yes, well, I mean, that was the weird and frightening thing about it. I never expected that because, you know, I was like, you know, kind of on the surface, I think, you know, blood for oil. We went in to get the oil. And, you know, as I say, you got to be careful about saying no blood for oil because a lot of Americans think that's a bargain. But the truth is that, in fact, big oil is very concerned about having too much oil on the market. Exxon is making $10 billion every 3 months, clear profit. No one's seen anything like that since the Pharaohs. And as you pointed out, the value in the rise of their current reserves, Exxon Corporation alone, is two-thirds of $1 trillion in increase in value since the war began. I mean, it's just beyond...
That's the reserves that they own outside of OPEC.
That's right. Outside of OPEC, the reserves that they own have gone up by two-thirds of $1 trillion because of the war and because of their working with OPEC. And as you say, you know, and I want to emphasize this, it is actually illegal. OPEC is a constraint, a conspiracy against the market. It is against American law, what we call the long-arm provisions of the Sherman Antitrust Act. But somehow we seem to make some type of exception for, you know, dictators and bathrobes and crowns.
Greg, can you stay with us and talk a little more after the break?
Sure.
We'll be right back with Greg Palast, author of the New York Times bestseller, Armed Madhouse.
Ahead, we'll also go back to the phones, 866-389-FIRE. Stay with us, Mike Papantonio and Bobby Kennedy on Ring of Fire right here on Air America Radio.
Cheney checks his voicemail.
You're lucky. As a cockroach, you'll actually survive the nuclear war you're working so hard to incite.
Ring of Fire.
We're back on Ring of Fire on Air America Radio. Mike Papantonio and Bobby Kennedy. If you want to give us a call, call us at 866-389-FIRE. That's 866-389-3473.
Right now, we're back with Greg Palast, author of the New York Times bestseller, Armed Madhouse. We're talking about big oil and the hidden agendas of the war in Iraq. Okay, well, Greg, here's the missing piece of this puzzle, which is also in your book, which I found so interesting. Of course, OPEC does not benefit its members unless it creates shortages, because the shortages creates demand and that drives up the price. Yeah. So you have to create a shortage. But if you create a shortage, you're telling your members you can't sell your product. And that hurts them financially. So what OPEC has done, its philosophy, has been to pick on one member of the cartel since its inception, and that's been Iraq, to unfairly limit the amount of oil that Iraq could export. And that system has kept Iraq down for many years. It's one of the hidden agendas behind this war. In fact, the invasion, as you point out, by Saddam Hussein of Kuwait occurred because Kuwait was sticking oil wells under Iraqi soil and sucking up Iraqi's oil.
Yes, they were stealing through a common pool of oil. They were sucking up their common oil. And in fact, that's one of the reasons why James Baker actually said you could roll your tanks, actually told Saddam he could invade. But the assumption was that he would only go in and take back some of those fields. But yes, see, Iraq's always been the goat. In every gang, and OPEC's a gang, it's a mob, there's always one goat, one sad sack, and the sad sack's always been Iraq. And they're the guys who've always had to take the hit on reducing their oil production. Iraq has nearly, under the ground, has nearly as much oil as Saudi Arabia, which is astonishing. Yet they've only drilled 15 fields out of 75 that they have. And that's because they were always told this is your limit. And it goes back to the creation of Iraq in 1920 by Winston Churchill, who basically took three oil fields. He took the Basra field to the south, Kirkuk and with the Kurds in the north, and the tar sands around Baghdad, and said, you're Iraq. And the purpose there was to give a concession to Anglo-Persian oil, which is now known as British Petroleum, and Standard Oil, now known as Exxon. And those guys agreed. They actually signed an agreement in a hotel room in Brussels in 1925, agreeing that they would not produce out of Iraq. They put a big red line around Iraq and Syria and said, we're not producing there.
So, and just to summarize this, going into Iraq for this latest war, the neocons wanted to go in there. They drove the issue from the beginning because they wanted to privatize, and they saw this kind of a utopia where you'd have $20 a barrel of oil because it was going to be privatized, and all of a sudden all of the Iraqi oil would be released to the national market and the back of OPEC would be broken.
Yes.
The oil companies went along with the war, but for a different objective. They thought the war itself would cripple oil production and therefore increase the shortages and drive up demand.
What they had was a meeting in December of 2000 after the Supreme Court selected Mr. Bush for us to come up with an international oil policy that would determine what we do, whether it's in Venezuela or Texas or Iraq. And this meeting was the James Baker people with the Council on Foreign Relations. I know this sounds like Illuminati stuff, but they do what our
the whole book does. The problem is there's footnotes. It's all documented.
Yeah, I know. It's tough. And, oh, by the way, one way that I found out about this is I did tape record the oil company's executives involved. And one of them, when I put part of this in Harper's Magazine, one oil company executive called up Harper steaming mad, saying, you know, with his lawyer, we're going to sue you. We never even talked to Greg Palast. And the editor, Lewis Lapham, said, well, fine, we'll retract that section of the article as long as you tell us which part of this audio tape is not you. You know, that's why people ask why tape. Now you know why. But in talking to these executives, they had these meetings, and we have this in writing. They wanted to present to the president, which means Dick Cheney. They basically presented to Dick Cheney what they call the military option for Iraq, because Saddam Hussein was jerking the oil markets. He was out of control, destabilizing markets. They were afraid one week he would short the market, then the next week they were afraid he was going to bust right through the oil for food limits and ultimately the OPEC quotas, that he was completely out of control. And the oil companies could not sustain and tolerate Saddam's jerking the market around. This is before the inauguration.
So they had their agenda, which was to stabilize their markets. The neocons had their agenda, which was to crush OPEC. But
yep.
Once we were in Iraq, the neocons thought, okay, we can finish our plan. And the oil industry stepped in there and said, wait a second. And they got rid of the Chalabis, they got rid of the Bremers, they got rid of the Wolfowitzes, and they put their agenda down, which is to make sure Iraq does not overproduce oil.
That's the game of it. In other words, like, and they keep this secret for a very simple reason. I think most Americans have this like ill feeling that it's about the oil. When you see it in black and white in the plans, and you see even a couple pages of these documents in our madhouse, when you see it, it is pretty ill-making, because there it is. They actually have the plan, and you can't carry it out without, you know, letting a little blood.
Right. And we have 2,500 dead kids over there. 10,000 have lost an arm or a leg or parts of their brain. Greg, we have to sign off now. It's been wonderful having you.
Bobby, thank you.
Greg Palast is author of the New York Times bestseller Armed Madhouse, and it's required reading on the Ring of Fire summer reading list, so go get it if you haven't already.